You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson, and on today's programme, fears of the far right dominated the headlines in 2017. But has populism now hit its peak? My guests Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Gaia Lutz and Matt Alagaya will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including after today's draw for next year's World Cup in Russia, is mixing politics and football unavoidable? And we'll look ahead to mulled wine, raclette and a host of international guests as we gear up for this weekend's Monocle Christmas Fair. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. And I'm delighted to say my guests in the studio today are Midori House faithful, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Gaia Lutz and Matt Alagaya. It was perhaps the biggest threat to Europe's political order in 2017. The rise of the far right gave the French a run for their money in May. Geert Wilders raised the stakes in the elections in the Netherlands. But both attempts to woo the electorate failed. So has populism peaked in 2017, or is it still alive and well and gaining traction in the eastern part of Europe? Well, for our in-house debate, Matt, let's begin with you. It's a funny thing that this felt like the year that populism nearly won.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what's quite interesting is how populist candidates sort of went into presidential elections. And they did very well, but obviously because a presidential election, you have to get pretty much over 50% to do well, or you get nothing. So these candidates like Marine Le Pen, like Norbert Hofer, did very well, but didn't quite get the presidency in their countries. And so there was this kind of collective sigh of relief across Europe when that happened. Everyone's like, oh, phew, okay, we've managed to keep populism out. But actually, what we've seen more recently is that when it comes to parliamentary elections, where a percentage is actually the thing that you're looking for, they've done very well. So this is, you know, in Germany, which is basically the heart of Europe, you know, the AfD have done incredibly well in the last couple of months. And then the Freedom Party more recently in Austria, they look like they're now going to be part of the government along with Sebastian Kurz. So I think it looked like they were going to get in, but then didn't. But actually, kind of through the back door almost, through these parliamentary elections, they've managed to get quite a lot more seats than they ever have before.
So the populism probably hasn't gone away. It's just becoming more arguably integrated into the way that we do things. People, we're going to have to accept the fact that we're going to take a more populist view. But Guy, I wonder how we sort of define populism nowadays, because it's that difficulty, isn't it? What someone in Catalonia might say, I'm fighting for my freedom, I'm fighting for my rights, I'm fighting for the identity of my own country, people in Madrid might strongly disagree with that and say, actually, no, you're being populist and almost, dare I say it, racist.
I definitely agree, Emma. I think it's very hard to define. I mean, we see right-wing populists, we see left-wing populists. But I think there's something sort of that runs in common with most of these leaders. And I think that they're riding sort of this wave of anxiety, of fear of globalization, of fear of these values, national identity. And I think as Matt was saying, you know, in these parliamentary elections, when we look at Eastern Europe, I think this point of the national identity becomes even stronger. You know, these were countries that were ruled by the Soviet Union for so long. Therefore, you know, they're very, very careful and very proud of their identity now. And so questions on immigration become heightened, and questions on the EU also become heightened, because that's, you know, governance from Brussels, that's, you know, giving up their independence, one might say. So yeah, definitely very different kinds of populists, but I think you can see some common threads.
The common threads that a lot of us have seen, a lot of the things that we've seen, Fernando, and the likes of Brazil for a very, very long time. The party which says it will represent the rights of the worker, of the common man or woman who is deprived of that opportunity in life by those who run the country. I mean, that was what Marine Le Pen said, that was what was said in Austria, and lo and behold, it's what's said in the United Kingdom, and look what happened there. Arguably, that was our populist vote, wasn't it? But in Brazil, they've been fighting like that forever.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting as well, I think it's happening in Brazil and in Eastern Europe more specifically as well. It's not only always about the economy as well. That's what I'm finding out. I think identity became a huge thing. And it's interesting that you mentioned Brazil. I think for the first time next year, we have a far-right candidate doing very well. And people are actually not voting for him because they think he's going to be the savior of our economy, but they're voting for moral values, for the thing that he will, I don't know, for some reason, heightened our presence in the world in some ways. And it's fascinating looking at the Eastern European example. For example, Poland. They have an all right economy, but they really, you know, the nationalist parties are doing very well.
It's interesting in that way, isn't it, Matt, that you mentioned the nationalist, that Fernanda mentions the nationalist parties doing terribly well. But we are seeing the effects of a nationalist rhetoric going wrong once it enjoys some degree of success. We look at what's happening in the United Kingdom with the Brexit process. No one, I think, would be saying that it was a success at the moment. And in fact, everybody is more and more anxious about what we're about to lose as opposed to what we're about to gain by closing a door. And also, you have to look at the United States. Donald Trump sailed into power in a populist wave, and yet the tax reforms that he's proposing will leave those most vulnerable off. Even worse off. So do you think that when we saw the likes of Geert Wilders not winning, Marine Le Pen not winning, do you think people actually took one look at how populism wasn't working?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think actually the way that we're judging the success of populists is not necessarily how the populists judge themselves. So I think something like Brexit, you know, we look at it and say, this is awful for our economy. But actually, that was the argument we were using before the vote. And It wasn't that effective. I mean, Fernando's absolutely right that the economy isn't that important to a lot of the people who are responding to populism and populist policies. You know, we told them, we said it was going to be difficult. It was going to make the economy weaker. And yet people still were like, well, actually, you know, we want our sovereignty. We want our identity back. And these things were much more important than the economy. So when we judge it on economic performance, I think that's one way of looking at it. But in terms of sovereignty and identity, you know, Trump voters are still pretty happy, I would have thought. And Brexit voters are pretty happy with the rhetoric they're hearing from Westminster when they talk about Brussels and say that Brussels is, you know, full of whatever and they can go whistle and all of that.
Yeah, the intransigence of the 27 member states. I mean, when we look at the way that we're having to now adapt our politics slightly, are we seeing, Guy, this sort of effort now to appease the far right when politicians and governments are trying to make sure that they can create some sort of stable government? Matt mentioned a little while ago the fact that Angela Merkel's efforts to cause form a coalition are being ruined by the fact that the political spectrum now is so broad that no one can agree.
And I think that's actually one of the biggest dangers of populism. It's not really perhaps the leaders that make it into power, but just shifting the entire debate towards them. And I think we've seen that a lot actually here in Europe, where even in those countries that we've talked about before, in the Netherlands, in France, you know, politicians have had to adapt their policies to appease that part of the population. And I think in that sense, as Matt was saying, that can be categorized as a small victory in a certain extent. Yes, they didn't make it to power, but the debate has entirely shifted. We are, you know, here in the United Kingdom, we were just talking about immigration laws. It is a much more right-wing country, even though Nigel Farage did not make it to power. And I think that is an interesting way it's turning out in events.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, I think Austria is a really good example of that. You know, we saw Sebastian Kurz move massively to the right because he saw the Freedom Party and how powerful they were becoming and how popular. And so he basically ran the party. He's only 31 years old, ran the party in this incredibly right-wing way and succeeded. And now it looks like he might even join the Freedom Party in government. So you can see how the entire debate in that country has been moved by one party that were at one point on the very extreme right and are now somewhere near the mainstream.
What does it do to a country, Fernando? I was having a conversation with a friend of mine earlier today that in the run-up to Christmas, everybody gets angry because everybody has got stuff to do and no one wants to let anybody else through. We're all busy. But in the last couple of years in the United Kingdom, at least, our political views are now so polarised that one has almost got the impression that people are now spoiling for a fight at almost, you know, whether you're trying to get a place in a car park or what your fundamental political views are. People are now a lot rawer when it comes to dealing with each other.
And I think that's the very sad state of things. It's the human side. I think societies are becoming more polarized, and it's not only the UK, I can tell you, it's happening in Brazil. And we have huge divisions, actually, of people that live in cities and people who live in small towns, and they're not even friends anymore, you know? So I think we're losing something. And I find it quite sad because I personally, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago, I didn't see the situation. And in the UK, as you mentioned, it's vividly how, you know, if you're a Brexiteer or a Remainer, whatever, of course, if, you know, ideally you could be friends, but that's not what's happening.
So step in the role of the European Union, supposed to be that umbrella, at least in Europe, which brings us all together and unites us under a beautiful flag and plays us a bit of Beethoven. I mean, how much is the EU either succeeding or failing to deal with the likes of, you know, whoever it is in Hungary, Viktor Orban, right-wing nationalists in Poland, Jarosław Kaczynski, who is eroding democracy at a rate of knots? The EU doesn't seem to have got a grasp on things, does it?
Well, this is the funny thing. I mean, we in the UK think that Brexit must be the thing that's keeping Angela Merkel and people in Brussels up all night. Actually, they've kind of moved on from Brexit. The biggest problem for the EU at the moment is this group of countries called the Visegrad nations. And this is Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And they are all moving towards, well, they've all already got populist governments and populist leaders of one sort or another. Viktor Orban and Jaroslaw Kaczynski particularly are trying to turn their countries into kind of one-party states and are very authoritarian. And that is a huge, huge crisis for the EU because it's kind of, they can't really do anything. They're sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't. You know, if they try and intervene, then it's seen as intervention by the EU, a sort of big block on their country. And these people are talking all the time about sovereignty. So they can't really do anything in that case. But if they ignore them, then those countries are just going to keep going.
And I was just going to say that it's exactly what Matt was saying, but I think these countries are actually posing a huge challenge to the EU. And I think the EU, we often see it as, you know, a thing that's made and it's there. But it's, you know, when these challenges come along, you see that it's, you know, something being made along the way. With Poland, I think it has huge difficulties of exactly what Matt was saying. How far can we, you know, sanction this country for, you know, what it's doing to its own press or judiciary? Is this, you know, are we invading its own sovereignty? Is this, and the EU is learning, let's say. It's a big test for what is the EU and how far can it go? And I think it'll be interesting to see in a couple of years what the EU can in effect do.
Indeed. Its focus ultimately having to be on people. But the just striking that appalling balance when it comes to geopolitics, which can often mean that, you know, as we've seen in Catalonia a few weeks ago, the EU accused of long fingering the crisis there because they didn't want to wade in because of the greater picture. Well, let's leave that idea, but keep the idea of the political sensitivities that we're all dealing with, because it should be football's crowning glory, but crises at FIFA and doping scandals from the Sochi Olympics have taken the gloss from today's draw for next year's World Cup. The setting was magical, the wintry splendour of the Kremlin, with ice rink, twinkly lights and sausage stalls outside to give Muscovites a seasonal pick-me-up. What more could you ask for? Or Vladimir Putin. So who's playing against who, however? Pretty secondary this year to the dangerous politics that surrounds the tournament and its host nation. Well, Guy and Matt and Fernando join me to continue. Let's start with you, Fernando. Passionate about Brazil and passionate about football, so we're expecting passion. But one newspaper described the draw before it happened as a contest between fun and fear.
Yeah, I wish it would be only fun. But it's interesting. I have to admit, there's quite a lot of similarities between the World Cup in Brazil and the one in Russia, because when both countries won the World Cups, they were in a very good moment economically, very optimistic societies, everybody was looking forward. But you know what happened in Brazil. I think 2014 was the first year that, you know, the crisis hit hard. Brazil in the end was an alright event, you know, I think we did well in organizing. I think the same is happening to Russia. But there's only one problem here as well. I don't think Russians are as passionate about football as Brazilians. In fact, I believe President Putin, football is definitely not his sport. But I just wish him the best. I'm sure there will be an uptake in tourists, but not more than that. There will be quite a lot of white elephants, the usual problems as usual.
Too much expectation of teamwork if Putin's going to be, for Putin's taste, I suspect. I think he quite likes solo combat.
Yes.
But Guy, I mean, the fact that Vladimir Putin provided an opening address at the Draw. This is his opportunity to make a political capital out of what effectively is a lot of people playing a nice match.
Yes, I tend to agree and disagree with that. I mean, I think it's inevitable that these big sporting events become a sort of a political debate. But in a way, you know, like Fernando said, comparing it to Brazil, there was so much negative press. It was so much about the politics. It was so much about where the money is going. Where could the money have been going instead? Which are all fair questions. But I wish, you know, the World Cup is happening. I wish, you know, the attention could turn into, okay, let's make this a really fun sporting event. And not all, you know, there are some countries that have negative relations with Russia, but not all countries that are on, that are playing the World Cup do have negative relations with Russia. And I fear the sort of debate that's going on perhaps here about what's happening in Russia might sort of overshadow what can be a really fun event, how it did in a way leading up to the Brazil World Cup, which I think is a bit sad. I mean, it's inevitable, but I thought it was a bit sad. And the way it was, we did pull off a great event, and it did bring very good news to Brazil, maybe not long term, but, you know, for the month it lasted, it was great fun.
But, you know, you have the allegations of corruption when it comes to the way that Brazil organises its sport. And Matt, also we had the doping scandals from the Sochi Olympics. I mean, before they've even started, Russia has blown itself power, hasn't it?
Completely. And I think, I mean, I agree to a certain extent with what Faye and Guy have said. But I think when you look back at 2009, when Putin started bidding or decided he was going to bid for the World Cup, completely, as Faye was saying, you know, Russia was on the cusp of becoming this great nation again. And I think he saw it as Beijing 2008, really. You know, that was the moment that China really entered onto the world stage. And it was a sporting event, but it meant so much more than that. That was kind of China becoming this dominant world power. And I think that's what Putin wanted from the World Cup when he signed up for it. And since then, his image in the West and his image worldwide has been damaged. I mean, I think, first of all, you have to look at, you know, this. That was before Ukraine and even before Georgia. You know, that was before he invaded Georgia. And I think since then you've had, yes, the doping crisis, yes, the interference in the US and French elections, but also Russia's economy is now in dire straits. And I think one thing you have to say is that he's probably now looking at it as something that he just wants to get out of the way, really. It's probably become a bit of a burden, and he'll be very pleased when it's done.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Emma Nelson, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Gaia Lutz and Matt Alagaya. Join me in the studio. Fernando is just about to be replaced, however, by Ben Ryland. We have the Midori House tag team. Coming up, though, next, from government of all talents to consummate cronyism, we look at how to build a perfect political cabinet. Stay tuned with us on Monocle 24.
Visit our online shop, where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
It's 7:18 a.m. if you're listening in Auckland, 19:18 in Milan, 18:18 here in London. You're back with Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. It was a huge, hopeful opportunity for change, but Zimbabwe's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, chose veteran members of his own party, ZANU-PF, to make up the country's new cabinet. Opposition politicians were largely left out, despite the new leader earlier promising to reach out to all patriotic Zimbabweans. Well, still with me are Gaia Lutz and Matt Alagaya. Guy, were you surprised by this? I don't think I was.
Well, you could say no, of course, because, you know, this is the former right hand of Mugabe. You know, you could say he's, you know, his track record isn't great. He's not a great lover of perhaps democracy. But at the same time, you know, when you saw all the people coming out to the streets and, you know, this massive relief and celebrating when Mugabe left, I have to say I was a little hopeful for change. I can't say it would be, you know, right now, but I was a little bit disappointed that he didn't seize that opportunity to change things a little bit at least. I mean, of course, the real test will come next year in the elections. But I would have expected, you know, if you see the reactions of people after Mugabe left, that he could feel the atmosphere and sense that, you know, people wanted change and not more of the same.
It was that wonderful moment when we saw Mugabe go. We never saw him go. We don't even know where he is. But, you know, when you see Emmerson Mnangagwa and he roused everybody into a state of happiness, euphoria, hope, you know, all you need to do is just see the joy on people's faces. But I think many in that moment, there was a... people forgot that the transfer of power had happened in an entirely traditional way in terms of a military coup, a non-democratic transfer of power. So were we really to expect a sudden opening into a full and frank democratic discussion? I don't think we were.
I mean, I do think that would have been sort of foolhardy in its optimism. I mean, look, he said all of the right things in that opening address. He said everything that everyone wanted to hear in the stadium in Harare. But yeah, I think sensible analysts and sensible commentators were saying, look, just let's wait and see what he actually does, because this man has been responsible for terrible crimes. Well, terrible, yeah, you know, massacres in Matabele land. And he was called the crocodile. He was, you know, the right-hand man, as Guy said, of Mugabe. I think it would have been foolhardy to think that he was going to be, you know, everything that he said in that speech and offer everything that he said he was going to. It does feel like a massive missed opportunity. And certainly you feel for the Zimbabweans who were on the streets that day when Mugabe finally stood down and were celebrating, because they have been betrayed by this. But as Guy says, it's much more important that what happens in the election next year, that is crucial. And if there can be any reforms after that, then we start to be a bit more hopeful.
But the construction of the perfect cabinet, someone I spoke to a little while ago was saying that actually somewhere in 10 Downing Street, those who are not actually in power, but those who help those in power, often play games of fantasy cabinet. And I think they had Gary Lineker as Minister for Sports, Arts and Culture. And there was that ability that if you could get rid of all the politicians, would you actually do a better job? Now, we've seen that happen in France, haven't they? The Emmanuel Macron positively encouraged people who had no political background to get involved. Because the risks, Gaia, when you start recruiting from the same gene pool politically, is that you get the same mistakes again and again.
Definitely. And I think you've touched on a very accurate point, is this diversity. And diversity comes in, you know, all forms and shapes. A lot of people only stick to, you know, having more women, which is definitely very, very important, and diversity of races. But there's diversity of, you know, background and you know, expertise, let's say. I can say from the Brazil cabinet, you know, after the impeachment of Dilma, we had Temer come in, and he did a perhaps worse job than what's happening in Zimbabwe now at forming his cabinet. He had no women in the country and no black people in his cabinet. This is a country that's a majority mixed race. And so it was a huge outcry. Now he has one woman sort of there to sort of...
Hurrah.
Yeah. And you know, and that same woman is the one black person of the cabinet. So, I mean, there's so many bad examples. But as you pointed out, you know, France has been apparently doing a much better job and you know, increasing its diversity in all sectors. He made a 50% obligation for women.
And ultimately, your cabinet is only as strong as its leader. I don't wish to dwell too much on the misfortune of Theresa May, but it is Schadenfreude personified. Theresa May, for me, the absolute epitome of feminism gone right. We have a mediocre person in charge who won't leave. You know, it's one of those great things. That is how the world has been operating for years and years. And the day that the same number of women who are dreadful at their jobs are in power as there are men, then we'll all be all right. But she is finding herself completely controlled by her cabinet. She is unable to make a decision because she just can't.
I mean, the British politics is kind of fascinating when it comes to this, because cabinets are always these kind of farcical places where you have infighting and backbiting. And the interesting thing about this one is that it's split down the middle. And I guess the big reason for that is, I mean, we keep coming back to it, but Brexit, you know, half of the cabinet basically voted Remain and the other half voted Leave. They are never going to get on when that is the biggest issue of this cabinet and the biggest issue of this parliament. And it's fascinating to watch. And I think Theresa May, kind of in fairness to her, I mean, I agree with you, I think she's an incredibly mediocre politician. But in fairness to her, I think she had a completely impossible task here. You know, she had to appease the Leave voters, the Brexiteers, when she herself voted Remain. And she has to kind of keep the Remain side of her party on side as well. And at the same time, try and get a good deal out of Europe when she has no bargaining power. It was difficult.
It was difficult, and it will be. It's enough to make you want to go and bury yourself in a box set, which is what we move to now. We're going to talk about television, and here's a little bit of good fighting, because so much has been made in the past couple of years of the changing way in which we watch television on demand and online. We now nibble at or binge on whatever shows we please, whenever and wherever. But things are changing, and the traditional broadcasters are having to get a little bit more nimble. Well, Gaia and Matt is still with us, but also Ben Ryland, host of The Cinema Show and all-round Mr. Television, comes in and tells us a little bit about where we watch television. Hands up, I don't really watch much television because I have now found that the world is too complicated. I can't be bothered to see if my Netflix account is working. I can't remember my password. The internet never works. So I just throw it in the bin and get cross. Guy, you just put your hands up and say, I don't watch telly either.
I don't watch much television either. But I have to say, you know, all throughout my university years, whenever I did watch anything, it would be on Netflix or sort of on demand. Lately, I've been spending a lot of time with my grandmother, and I've rediscovered television, actual television that I haven't watched for ages. And I've realized, you know, whilst before I was like, ugh, advertisements, I don't want to watch this. I realized that for, you know, older people, it has this sort of like companionship.
It's cute.
It feels like it's theirs. It's not something so isolated as Netflix. So I'm suddenly rediscovering the positive of television.
Ben, you're sort of coming in to explain to us a little overarching strategy that many of the traditional broadcasters, who Granny Gaia might be absolutely dependent on, are having to be told to shape up.
Yes, I mean, look, it is essentially a very good thing in that this competition from the online behemoths, Amazon, Netflix and so on, it has actually forced a lot of those traditional broadcasters into the modern age, shall we call it. You know, if it weren't for the Netflixes and so on, we wouldn't have the on-demand platforms that the BBC offers, or in Australia, the ABC. You know, you can actually watch a lot of the shows you want to watch on demand now without actually having to have a television. But as Gaia hints at there, I think there is something to be said about that about the schedules that television broadcasters actually operate under. The schedule, you know, primetime viewing, that is the television equivalent of the front page on the newspaper. That is the broadcaster saying to you, this is worth your attention. We're telling you this is important. Therefore, we're putting it on the 6 p.m. news as the lead story, or we're putting it as the lead item on Newsnight. You know that, and that's very important. You don't get that on Netflix. That endless scroll, that can actually be information apocalypse. It can really lead you to be a bit of an idiot sometimes, I think.
So, excellent.
You know, the news is important.
If the news is important, but Matt, the money that was being ploughed into news is you know, broadcasters don't have that anymore because everyone's going to Netflix.
That is true, and that is going to be a huge problem for most of our public broadcasters and a big challenge. But I think they are kind of meeting that challenge by having on-demand services and things like that. I would just say that, I mean, I think, you know, we were talking about the breakdown of community earlier and that leading to populism. I do think there is a really important thing here about public broadcasters is the fact that everyone shares that together. You know, people sit down in front of the telly and they watch that together. Whereas services like Netflix, what they actually do is just show you what you like, and you become this kind of siloed individual with all your friends watching the same shows, and you're never really given anything that's really outside your comfort zone.
No, so you need to get out a bit more.
Right. There's not much editorial process in selecting what's on Netflix, you know. It's an algorithm, whereas you've actually got people who would call themselves professionals. You know, they are seasoned people who are there because they want to do a very good job. And at least I think when you're talking about the world's leading public broadcasters, what's being put on at certain times is being chosen by someone because they believe it is of the public good, that it meets their mandate, and that you know, it meets the reasons that the ABC or the BBC actually is there to exist, and that is to inform people. It's not just to entertain.
Okay, finally, It's the first weekend in December, which means only one thing, the transformation of Midori House into a festive wonderland. It's a Monocle Christmas market here tomorrow and Sunday. The elves have beads of sweat under their brow. Santa is oiling his beard. Gaia, are you on the tombola again?
I am on the tombola. I have to say, Emma, I'm not quite sure what are the top prizes this year.
It's going to involve cashmere of some kind.
Surely.
Cashmere, I've had a bit of a scout around. I don't know if you have. I mean, it is wonderful here at Midori House, isn't it? When we invite all these wonderful people who make wonderful things and cook us wonderful food and give us lots of wonderful wine to drink. And everybody just has this lovely conviviality among it. And you just think, actually, this is when Midori House gets a little bit of magic, doesn't it?
Totally. I mean, it gets really, really festive. We've had reindeers here. We've had Santa all the way from Lapland. You know, we've had holly and mulled wine. And yeah, you're right. I think it's a really good, fun, and it's very much a neighbourhood event as well. I think everyone who lives within a mile radius comes to Midori House and
Indeed.
Tries the tombola.
And you can hear the reindeer have a good old struggle as they're led meekly out. But they're
That's
lovely.
True.
They're beautiful things.
And Emma, don't forget, we will have the stack live from 10 a.m. tomorrow. So 10 a.m. London time, that is. So do be sure to tune in.
We'll be broadcasting all day live from between 8 and 3 every single day at the Monocle Christmas Fair. Georgina Godwin will be behind the microphone tomorrow. I will be there. Generally, they put us between the mulled wine and the reindeer, so do come and say hello if you want. That brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to Matt Alagaya, Gaia Lutz, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Ben Ryland too. Today's show was produced by Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, research by Tasha Kleeman, and our studio manager was David Stevens. Doors open from about 10-11 tomorrow at Midori House. Come along to the Monocle Christmas Market if you wish. It will be lovely. It'll be cosy. You can buy lavender and jewellery and everything. And you can meet Father Christmas. For now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.